From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, I have a problem with my antenna system.
Not again.
Every day, it's something new. Now, this is what I told you about some time ago, where you had suggested a choke, not for my throat, but for the antenna, preferably, to eliminate currents going up and down and what that would do to the SWR. And actually, you're right. That was the problem. I did install the choke. Everything was hunky-dory. But it made me think about troubleshooting antenna systems generally. I mean, hams run into all sorts of problems. Is there an approach you would recommend?
There are a number of approaches, and it's kind of tricky because it often can be hard to tell if your antenna is working well or not. For one thing, a broken antenna sounds very much like a dead band.
Yes.
And especially at night when you can't look out the window and see what the antenna is doing, it can be very hard to tell which the problem is. And while it's generally easy to fix antennas, it's hard to fix dead bands, so it can be a problem. The approach I like the best, and the one I've always used, is I always try to have multiple antennas that will cover different frequency ranges. Just because of that reason, if it sounds like the band is dead on one antenna and I switch to another antenna and the band isn't dead, then I have a good reason to believe my first antenna was not working.
Now, what you'll often hear, though, is they'll say, maybe not so much the band is dead, although that's surely a good symptom of a malfunctioning antenna. What I typically hear on the air from other hams, though, is, wow, my SWR jumped sky high. That is their chief symptom.
That is a good indicator of something going wrong, no question about it. And it's the next test to make, and if you don't have a second antenna, it's a good test to make. And typically, if the SWR reads not just good, but what it did back when it was working. And this is why, you know, I go, one of the things to do, it's important, I think, and I stress this in a number of directions, take data on your antenna, the SWR, on every antenna, three or four frequencies across the band, write it in your log, and have it in place.
Absolutely.
And then when you're wondering about it, you can go back and say, well, not only does the SWR look good, but is it the same as it was before? Because if it isn't, something has happened to the antenna.
Something has changed.
And a low SWR can indicate problems of its own.
That's right.
If you have high transmission line loss, you get water in your transmission line or something, you may find that the SWR has improved. You say, oh boy, my antenna is getting better. No, it's not. What's happening
it's getting worse.
Your transmission line is getting worse. And so unless you know what the SWR was when you first put it up, and have that as a baseline to look at, it can be very difficult to tell. One of the problems is many kinds of antenna problems are the result of things that degrade slowly, transmission lines being one, corrosion in connections being another, losses in traps and things can happen. I mean, sometimes antennas fail dramatically. That's usually pretty easy to tell. The SWR was 1.5 to 1, now it's 400 to 1.
Yes.
You know something dramatic has happened. But if it was 1.5 and now it's 1.6, what does that mean? So small changes in antenna performance are very difficult to notice. You have a weekly schedule with somebody, and over the years, his signal level drops down. Now, is that because of the sunspot cycle, or is that because his antenna has gone down, or your antenna? It's very difficult to pick up on exactly what's happening with slow degradation, which is why I think it's important to have the baseline data. You can go back and say, let me check this on all bands, and I can get a pretty good idea if anything has changed. If nothing has changed, it is probably as good as it was when I put it up, and that's always reassuring. Now, there are some exceptions. We talked last time about Yagis. The SWR may not be a good indicator of Yagi performance. It's a good indicator that the energy is going into the driven element, but it's a little tougher to tell exactly what's happening in all the parasitic elements by looking at the SWR. So that for that, you need some other kind of baseline. If you have nearby beacon stations that operate with a steady, reliable signal that doesn't change much with atmospheric conditions, so they're not close enough so the antenna is not looking in the far field, but they're not so far away that they're subject to atmospheric variation. This is a tough test. But maybe you can have a friend that's across town, and you can do a periodic check. and point your antennas to each other, or if they're fixed, that's there's no issue about pointing, and have him put a certain level signal on the air, and you measure your look at your S meter, and then and vice versa, and you record that in the log, and then every 6 months when you're talking to him, you can say, hey, let's do an antenna retest and see what's happening. And that's another good test, particularly of directive antennas.
Now, considering those dramatic changes, though, where you say you had an SWR of 1.5 to 1 and you fire up the radio today and suddenly it's 20 to 1, it could be a squirrel gnawing through your coaxial cable between your radio and your antenna, or it could be something with the antenna. I mean, where do you start?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of it depends on what you have access to. I mean, a nice thing to be able to do is take the coax cable off the antenna, put a dummy load and a power meter at the far end, and measure the amount of power that's coming out the end into a matched load. And that'll tell you how good the coax is doing on that frequency. That is a very good test. That's not always possible. Another interesting test you can do depends a lot on how the antenna is constructed. But let's say you have an antenna with a hairpin match. Now, a hairpin match is a small inductance across the feed point. That looks like a zero resistance DC connection. And if you measure resistance of your transmission line from the center conductor to the shield, you should measure the resistance of the cable itself and the hairpin. And if all the connections are good, that resistance shouldn't change over time. If it gets higher, that means you have a bad connection someplace. So that's one thing you can do. Similarly, if it's supposed to be an open circuit, like a dipole feed, split dipole feed, the impedance should be infinite when you look at that. So those are things you can test very quickly. Another thing you can do with the hairpin type match is measure the SWR at a much lower frequency where that should look like a short. If the transmission line is good, it's perfect, the SWR should be infinite. The chances are it's not. You can actually use a program like TLW to tell you what the SWR should be. Put 0 ohms as the load and tell it how long it is and the type of transmission line, it'll tell you what the SWR should be at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So you can compare that with what you measure, and that will tell you what the impedance is or what the loss is, and you can compare that with what it should be. So there are a number of things you can do with that sort. Another thing is ohmmeters on the antenna. You can actually measure very low resistances with a good ohmmeter across, if you have an antenna, say a Yagi with elements that are sleeved together, check across every joint. And I've found antennas in which the resistance measured half an ohm or something. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it should Mm-mm. be zero.
Yes.
And a half an ohm on a low impedance antenna can absorb a fair amount of power.
Now, where are you making these measurements?
With the antenna in your lap, which is tricky if it's on the top of a tower.
Yes, that was the thought. Yeah.
But let's face it, to fix an antenna, you got to have the antenna at hand.
Yes.
So if you get to that point, check every connection in the antenna, which is, you know, each element that sleeves together and there's a clamp. So forth, make sure that it measures 0.0 ohms. And if it doesn't, put a layer of conductive grease, of Noox or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Penetrox, I don't know. But they basically...
Maybe it's Penetrox.
Yeah. There are a number of different brands, but the basic idea is that they avoid the antennas sticking together with corrosion, which makes them hard to get apart and fix.
Yes.
They also help improve the conductivity between the sections. And then make sure they're tightly clamped down. Typically, the larger size is slit so that a clamp can provide pressure to squeeze down on the inner element. And that connection can get bad with corrosion if it's not properly installed in the first place. Check same way at the traps, if there are any. The connection from the beam to the trap, the connection through the trap. If there's a coil there, it should measure 0.0 ohms if there's nothing. Connections held together with rivets, particularly aluminum rivets in my experience, tend to migrate away and eventually make less pressure and less contact, and the resistance goes up. And sometimes just squeezing them with vice grips can bring them back together, or sometimes drill them out and replace them with good stainless machine screws, lock washers, and nuts tightened down properly.
Well, that's a good point. Let's take a break, 60 seconds, and hear from our sponsor, DX Engineering.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back. Joel, I want to keep going on the question of SWR changes that indicate something wrong with your antenna.
Okay.
If my SWR suddenly jumps, as I said before, sky high, do I need to run outside with a dummy load to the antenna, attach the dummy load in, you know, in where the coax attaches to the antenna? If I see at that point, however, that the SWR is still high, then obviously that says to me that there is a problem in my transmission line between the dummy load back to my radio. How do I find where that point is?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, you may save yourself some trouble by not immediately running outside, particularly in the winter, in your pajamas or something. Yes. But in my station, for example, the transmission line goes through a number of transitions before it gets out to the outside world. Maybe a balanced, unbalanced balun or common mode choke that's connected in, so you've got a couple of connectors there. Always look for mechanical things first, I think. I mean, squirrels is another question, but...
Yes.
But, and then it goes through my basement and goes to my entrance panel where there's a lightning arrestor and a connection to ground. So I've got probably four or five coaxial connections along the way before it even gets outdoors.
Four or five points of failure.
Potential points of failure, exactly. And one of them that's fairly significant is the lightning arrestor itself, because lightning arrestors can fail in a number of different ways, but if they are tripped, and how would they get tripped? If the voltage is higher than the threshold, which can happen if you have a high SWR for a little bit, that can actually cause the lightning arrestor to fire, and that could end up at a short or a near short.
Certainly.
It could also end up as an open. It's sort of hard to tell. That's perhaps a subject for another day, but I would go through and check each one of those connections. If you get on, now one thing I've done at that connection point, I have a couple of different station locations in my house, and I have at that antenna entrance panel, I have a patching capability that I can patch antennas to different parts of the house. So if I forgot what I did or put the wrong one on and I come down and or I'm in the upstairs station and turn it on and I get a high SWR, oftentimes what it means is the antenna is routed to the downstairs station. So it's good to check your connections. Another thing that can happen if you have a patch panel, as I do, and you disconnect the antennas when there's a lightning storm around or before there's a lightning storm around, if you put them back in the wrong order and you're trying to use the 2-meter beam on 20, it often has a high SWR.
It sure would.
Which raises the comment that I've discovered that it's very important to mark all the coaxes with. And what I use is a silver magic marker, not magic marker, one of those Sharpie pens.
Right.
And write on it what it's supposed to go to and write on the panel what the antenna is. And that way you're more likely to get them in the right place.
True.
So there are things like that that can happen. I mean, often if it's something that happens and it seems strange, the chances are you did something strange. At least in my house, that's what happens. So, you know, check all the connections on the way to the outside before you go outside in the cold with your power meter and scare all the neighbors.
But what if the connections are fine? Then what?
Well, then I think you have to continue on and look at the antenna. I mean, again, you can try to deduce it. Another thing you can do, some antenna analyzers, my Rig Experts, for example, has a built-in time domain reflectometer.
I was wondering when you were going to get to that. Yes.
And that can tell you what's going on along the length of the transmission line. So you can effectively send a pulse down the line, and it'll show every reflection point. So you'll see a little blip as it goes through a connector. But if you have a short or an open, you'll see a big blip come back. So knowing the length to the problem, you can very rapidly go directly to it. Now, you may not rapidly go up the top of the tower in your slippers, but that's a whole different question that you can't, you know, there's...
Or out under the trees where the dipole lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Or on the ground where it's fallen or wherever. So those are things you can do. I mean, there are a lot of diagnostic steps you can do. You can do a lot with an ohmmeter, too, especially if you've recorded measurements ahead of time and you know what they should be.
Absolutely. Well, are you ready for a question?
Sure, why not?
How about a question that has nothing whatsoever to do with antennas? Is
okay,
that okay?
That would be okay.
Well, we have Dwayne, Alpha Alpha 6 Echo Echo. Nice call sign.
Yeah.
He's asking, I enjoyed your review of the ICOM IC7851 transceiver in the July issue of QSD. One term that is new to me and is thus perplexing is panadapter. What is a panadapter waterfall view, he asks?
Well, that's a good question. And the traditional panadapter, which is fairly new in the amateur realm, relatively speaking, although they were offered actually by Hallicrafters right after World War II. I don't know how popular they were, but they were a little 2.5-inch screen, I think, with a little green tube. And basically what it shows is on the x-axis is frequency, and the y-axis, the amplitude axis, is amplitude of the signal. So you could look at the band and see on either side of where you were tuned what signals were present. That can be very handy, particularly if the conditions are such that bands are often dead. You can just look from across the room and see if there's any activity.
That's right.
Without having to scan back and forth. Modern equipment has similar, often comes with similar displays. But another option has shown up. I became aware of it at the time of the digital mode PSK31. The original DigiPan software that appeared with PSK31 included its display was what's called a waterfall display. This has frequency on the x-axis, as does the regular pan adapter, but instead of having the y-axis be amplitude, the y-axis is actually time. Mm-hmm. And the signals start at the top and go down like a waterfall. And a signal that's on the display looks like, therefore, a steady carrier looks like a line, vertical line, going down the screen over time. And with PSK31, for example, you see a pair of lines separated slightly, indicating the two phases of the signal, or two frequencies that end up resulting from that. And the way you use the PSK31 is you click in between them, and it automatically locks in and decodes the signal, because it's very hard to tell that signal is there otherwise, because the signals are often very weak and very near the noise. The lines show up in colors, and the colors change with amplitude, so you can get an amplitude sense as well as a frequency sense, and it shows what's happening over time. In fact, if you had a CW signal, it's kind of fun to watch this, the CW signal actually looks like dots and dashes on the screen.
That's right.
As it goes down the screen.
You can actually read it.
You can read it. You have to kind of hold your head sideways, but at least I do. But you can read it that way if you can read code off paper tape, like reading code off paper tape like people used to do.
That's right.
So it works very well, and it sometimes is much easier to see very weak signals than with the normal pan adapter display. The normal pan adapter, the signals really have to be well above the noise to see them, whereas signals on a waterfall just have to be almost at noise level, and you'll see a color change and so forth.
Now, one of the great things about a pan adapter is the fact that if you're trying to navigate through a DX pileup, let's say the DX station is spreading its pileup through what, 10 kilohertz maybe of spectrum?
Easily.
And you have all of these signals and you're thinking, where can I put my signal so that I have a chance of being heard? Well, the pan adapter, at least in my experience, will show me where that hole is, if you want to call it that, where I can put my 100 watt to a dipole signal and stand a chance of being recognized by the DX station.
Absolutely. I use that same technique. It works very well. I don't use the waterfall view. I use the normal view for that usually, because usually the signals calling the DX station are pretty strong, so it's not too hard to see it. And you can also, another thing you can do is you can actually, if you look at it very carefully, you can sort of see the station that the DX station is talking to.
That's right.
If you're having trouble finding it. Because one of the techniques I use is to try to call on right very near the frequency that the last station was successful on. And with my dual receivers, I can hear that if I can find that station. But this way, if the DX station is working somebody and I don't hear them in the channel, I can see on the pan adapter which frequency is on. I can tune to that, and then I'm ready to go right then. So I can find that elusive signal. So
yes,
it's very handy for that. I wouldn't be without it.
Oh, yeah. They have a bunch of uses. Well, thank you, Joel. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.